Hello and welcome to another episode of the Challenger Cities podcast with me, Ian Montgomery. And I do some other podcasting things. One of them is called Sidebar, which is a podcast that fell out of the Innovator Social Club, where I basically host online and offline gatherings with people who work in innovation. I host this podcast with friend, former colleague, Charlie Rowat. We worked together at a company called Market Gravity back in the day. We've done various conversations where we talk about, is innovation a dirty word, or what does AI mean for innovation? So I thought it'd be good to do a bit of a crossover where we had a chat, and I really wanted to get Charlie to be the focus, albeit sometimes you can't shut me up, but talking about what corporate innovation and what urban innovation potentially learn from each other, and are there any sort of potential crossovers? Also, Charlie's been doing some really interesting work lately on a project into adult social care with an accelerator with some colleagues at the Thames Freeport, Rainmaking and Care City. So it's basically an accelerator based in East London that's aiming to tackle like the biggest problems in adult social care by bringing technologies from around the world and helping them in the care system realize their potential. I think this is a really good example of a project, and Charlie will talk about it in more detail, but adult social care has such a big fiscal burden on many councils and towns and cities and urban areas in the UK. So actually how you solve for that, of how people age happily, healthily, with dignity, with an aging population, I think is a really interesting sort of piece of making great Challenger Cities. So really what we'll cover is some of that experience and then where the similarities and differences might lie in terms of doing innovation in the corporate context and urban context. Without further ado, let's get into that with a conversation with Charlie Rowat. Charlie, we normally talk about innovation stuff, but we're going to put this one on Sidebar as the innovation podcast, and we're going to put it on Challenger Cities as the Future Cities podcast. So I thought you'd be the best person to talk to when it comes to how we bridge that gap between corporate innovation and urban innovation, where things are the same and where things are different, especially as you've been doing really interesting work around urban innovation lately. So it's kind of perfectly comes together.
It has certainly been very interesting. Yeah, perfect. I think this is a good bridge, a good crossover.
The thing I need to do though is I have an audience that doesn't know who you are. Don't know who Charlie Rowat is. So you're going to have to do that sort of introducing Charlie Rowat thing.
Okay. I am Charlie Rowat, and I have worked in and around innovation for the last 11 or 12 years or so. A series of different places, small consultancies, big tech companies, and now my own tiny little independent one-man band consultancy. And I think through all of that, I have tried to bring together ideas and strategy and making sense of those ideas for people who don't think in terms of ideas, but think in terms of money and value and things like that. And trying to bring that together with how people on the receiving end of those ideas, like actual just normal people out in the real world, actually behave and act and think and decide, and try and bring those different worlds of innovation and behavioral science together, which has been really, really fun. And yes, the last 6 months or so, I've been working with colleagues at Rainmaking to support a client, Thames Freeport, around innovation in two London boroughs and one Essex borough in the adult social care space, which has been very exciting.
So, question for you. How much of the corporate innovation stuff that you've done, because the urban innovation stuff's kind of come, the city stuff's come a bit later, how much of the corporate stuff applies to the city stuff?
I mean, all of it, I think. It's, you know, fundamentally, it comes down to people and how you understand the people you're designing for and how you understand the people that you're selling into, and finding ideas that bridge the gaps between those two groups of people. And yes, the circumstances are slightly different, but I think most of it applies. I think the biggest thing, to one of the biggest things that I found is, you know, we've been working with these local boroughs, local councils in London. And as people will know, if they have paid attention to media in the UK, which I don't know, maybe the Challenger Cities,
some people will, some people won't.
Yeah, won't have. But lots and lots of local councils in the UK are in quite precarious financial situations and don't have any budget really for innovation. Lots of will, lots of appetite, no real budget. And I don't mean that in the way that a corporate would say that when they're like, oh, we don't really have budget for this. I mean, literally, they are struggling to keep the lights on.
Yeah. I'm sure some corporates do.
I suppose they do. I don't usually work with the ones that are the corporates that are struggling to keep the lights on, to be honest. But what it means is there's a real, like, there's an acute commerciality about it. And whereas I think the commercial lens on innovation is just one lens that I like to bring to it.
Mm-hmm.
You've got to be really pointy about doing it in that local council context and doing it kind of up front. You kind of have to have the business case just to get people in the room, essentially. Yeah. Like, that's the first bridge. Like, you can't tell a good story. It needs to stack up in terms of how is this going to save money, preferably immediately, or further down the line.
Does that mean it's about, say, like, it's really interesting because I think a lot of people would look at cities and be like, you guys are really, like, lax with your money.
Mm.
But does it actually mean that, like, I think your argument is that they're being way more pointed with their money and being like, actually, we have to spend this really wisely. But does that then mean it's more about, like, cost rather than revenue?
Yeah, I think so. I think there's definitely the lens of, yeah, how do we deliver these services cheaply? So in the adult social care space that I've been working in, the adult social care budget, I think the average across the country is that it accounts for 40% of council spending on services, and that's just the statutory, like, that's just what they are required to deliver. So it's a massive part of their spending. So they are primarily concerned with how can we do that in a cheaper way.
Yeah.
The stuff that we were really looking at with them is how can you be more preventative, and how can you introduce technology solutions that are going to predict and prevent conditions? How can you introduce those early, catch things early, so that the costs of the care can be reduced because you don't need them? It becomes less about how do we deliver a service more cheaply, and it's how do we reduce the amount of that service that we need to deliver.
Yeah.
I think it's one stumbling block, and I think this definitely applies in the adult social care space, it probably applies in other areas of cities and councils as well, is that a lot of those cost savings are realized in other parts of government or other areas. So then again, it becomes, how do you justify that business case when actually we're going to spend the money, we're not going to see any of the
or the people who are choosing to spend the money and make the investment in the innovation, they won't necessarily get the credit for it, because by the time that people see the thing in the real world or see the thing starting to have the value, you're one, two more electoral cycles down the road.
Yeah, 100%. And I found it really interesting. Like, I've got really into kind of systems thinking in the last sort of few years, which is weird. Yeah. It's a good sniggery, and it's a very odd
I hate the term systems thinking, but that's yeah. Well, let's not get distracted for now.
We can do the next sidebar on systems thinking. But I think, like, what was quite eye opening for me is you can map out a system, you can understand the kind of root causes of things, and you can understand that the system is complex, and you can take stakeholders with you on that and show how, you know, doing this thing over here is going to have these benefits over here. But there are still all these other things that are driving these outcomes or influencing these outcomes, and you can't get rid of those. And again, when it comes to that commercial lens and that business case, it's much easier to say yes to something that's addressing a symptom at this level than it is a root cause down here, because the link is just so much stronger.
Yeah, but it's like you talked about how you often have to make the business case. I think we talk about this in corporate innovation, and it makes sense in urban innovation as well. But you have to make these, you become reliant on what are the things that I can pre-rationalize?
Mm.
And a lot of the time in systems thinking, like, even if you can sort of say the thing that's over here, I can then, if we do this over here, it will play through the system and have an impact. But there's other things that you will end up doing by making that change that have a way bigger impact that you couldn't have previously pre-rationalized. And then people will be like, right, is that, I think that there's a sort of trick of going, hang on, that led to something we might have had 100 happen, but we couldn't prove it would happen. Now we've proven it would happen. How do we pile in a load more investment and double down on our early bet, basically.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that's the, you know, to go back to corporate innovation, like one thing that corporates are not great at doing is trying something, seeing what happens. And then, yeah, to your point, like pivoting if they need to do something different or investing somewhere else or, you know, not doing the thing that was original and just going, you know what, that hasn't worked. So let's kill it. Let's try something else. But they, yeah, tend not to be fantastic at, yeah, the learning in the, like in the flow.
Yeah.
Like let's try something. Let's experiment. Let's see what happens and have a vision, but experiment our way there. And I think that is a little bit more, potentially a little easier in sort of local council, city level. I think they tend to work in that way a little bit more, like just a little bit more naturally. They're just sort of, I think, a bit more used to dealing with, you know, we've got a heterogeneous population. Let's, you know, not the same thing is not going to work for everyone across our borough or across our city. Like there's lots of different people, like people can respond differently. Let's see how this works and experiment in small ways. I think we worked with a guy called Tim Pierce in the Barking and Dagenham Borough Council. He's ex behavioural insights team, the Nudge unit in the government, and he heads up Barking and Dagenham's insights and innovation team. And they've been doing some awesome stuff with big data. That's my words, not his, actually. I inserted the big. And part of what we're working with them on was, so falls are a massive problem for the in the UK, for the over 65s. It's about 2.3 billion costs the NHS every year. It's like the leading cause of death, basically, for over 65s. And if you are over 65, so one in three chance you're going to fall in a year. And that rises to like 50% chance over 75, I think. So they wanted to get upstream of this. We've built a model to predict people in the population who are at risk of falling. And then what they want to do is reach out to them and offer them services which they can take up to reduce those risks. And the model doesn't tell you exactly what the risk factor
is. What kind of services?
So anything from basic, like, let's get a handyman round and put grab rails on your corridors, or let's put a walk-in shower in. Like, these are services that the council provides anyway, but usually it doesn't happen until after someone's fallen over.
Yeah.
Or it could be a referral to physiotherapy and those sort of classic routes, pathways in the NHS around, like, you know, social prescribing and things like that. And then what we were working with them on was some of the technology solutions. So things like tools to help people adhere to their medicine better, and at-home platforms for helping people basically their strength and balance, which is, you know, kind of the root, one of the root things around preventing falls. And they were taking a really nice experimental approach and doing like a random controlled trial. And again, this is part of that culture of being a public body, being accountable for every penny that you spend, like wanting to get the evidence that we're spending this money in the right way. So let's do a small pilot, let's see what happens, and if it works, let's roll the results out, let's add more services in. So it was a really long-winded way, but I just wanted to give an example of that kind of that culture of experimentation being a little bit more embedded, and yeah, maybe it does come back to you know, wanting to have that evidence that the things that they are doing are the right things, but being willing to experiment to get there and to discover that.
There's more hunger for it as well, though, because if you have that, a giant portion of our budget is an aging population that we're ultimately on the hook for. And most councils in the UK, municipalities in North America, they don't have a lot of revenue generating capability. But what they do have is often quite like either hamstrung, or it can be like it's just not in their culture. So they can do it, but they've not got any history doing it very well, so it's hard to start it. So it makes you much more hungry of a, hang on, this is like an existential crisis. It's the burning platform for innovation, effectively.
Yeah.
And I think you see the once you get a taste for innovation, you get a couple of successes, it becomes very addictive. So I think it makes a ton of sense, because you're hungrier or you're more needy for it. So you try some things that you previously wouldn't try. If you get, not all of them work, so if some of them get traction, you'll do more things. So I've seen like urban innovation things that are very much like, we've done a program and we'll run a program for a year, and next year we'll come back and run a similar program because we've got budget to fund it for 3, 4, 5 years.
Mm.
Like, I can get quite cynical about them because they often feel like a bit of a performative exercise. Whereas, and you get that in corporate organizations as well, because it's a, we've got an innovation team, we funded it for, we've got budget for this long, and then
yeah,
it all goes away. But like the more existential, like our customer base is literally dying, or this new challenge, like competitive propositions popped up and it's harming us, that's when you tend to get more innovation in corporate. So it makes sense that that's where innovation can work really well in cities and public sector bodies, right?
Yeah, I think so. I think there's another similarity between corporates and public cities and councils, in that, you know, we've all seen corporate innovation where essentially there's been an idea at the top level.
Yeah.
Maybe CEO minus one, and it sort of gets pushed through the innovation process because, you know, they had the idea and they want to see it come to fruition. And I think that what you get in the public side is more that there are, NHS, for example, will have guidelines on fall prevention, and they'll have guidelines on, there's literally a thing called NICE guidelines on checklists for fall risks and things like this. And because those are sort of done at the top down level, there's almost like there's that level of evidence as well as the bottom up stuff. And you almost have to align to the priorities and the research to an extent that's being set at those sort of top like governing and mm-hmm. nationwide policy level bodies. Because otherwise you're really swimming against the tide, and it makes it a lot harder to get anything done. So you aligning to that, yeah, it's really, really quite crucial. And I think it's possibly more so than in a corporate, where there'll be a strategic direction from the top in a corporate. Mm-hmm. Aligning to that is very sensible, but usually the strategy is quite vague.
Mm-hmm. Well, if you take most CEOs, you tend to be like, if you said to them, what are your priorities? They'll have a list of between 3 and 6 or 7.
Mm-hmm.
If you're the innovation group, you don't really want the number one priority, because mm-hmm. then it's like the number one and number two priorities tend to be like very much, we need to go and deliver on this and there's no room for error. Whereas numbers 3, 4, 5 tend to be a little bit like, they're not headlines, they're not going to be the number one topic in the exec meeting. So you can be a bit more playful with it, and you can go and experiment. There's more scope for a bit of failure, and like, oh, we didn't actually solve the thing that you wanted us to solve, but we found this other interesting thing that could be meaningful and lucrative or whatever. If you took that and applied it to falls, then I doubt they're the number one or number two thing in the NHS, but they'll be a very serious, they'll be in the top handful. So then because there's the cost element, it's not all about like the NHS problem, it's also about the social care problem. So then, because you've got a shared responsibility, that's where it aligns nicely for innovation, where it's this isn't the most important thing. This isn't going to be Keir Starmer's sort of like big narrative about fixing the NHS, but do that well and you end up solving a gigantic financial problem. So I think that there maybe are similarities of where these things line up nicely.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point. You certainly unlock more funding, though, if you are tackling those bigger problems, I think.
Yeah.
And not just like government funding. Like, obviously, there's a bunch of kind of philanthropic funds and things that are attacking these bigger problems as well. So being able to kind of, yeah, draw down on some of that by, again, yeah, aligning yourselves to those problems. But I think that is the rub. It's this like, and it's the same in a corporate. There's the sort of on the ground, like here at the very local,
yeah,
problems, and there's the top down direction, and somehow you've just got to find a way to marry those two things up.
I hate to come back to the storytelling thing, but you need the sort of the narrative. Yeah. I think for cities, you have the narrative of what's the narrative to the, in the case of falls, what's the narrative to a 67-year-old widow in Barking? versus like the narrative to the local press, the narrative to the local NHS trust, to the narrative for the MPs, the narrative for the councillors. Like, you have to, I think, like, there's ones where you can do that quite easily, and then there's also the ones where, like, bang on about the mobility thing. Like, how do you sell the guys, we really just can't add more cars to the, but that means that you individually can't do the thing that you've had the privilege of doing so easily. Yeah. That's going to change, and like, that's where you can't, it's quite hard in an, like, if you took that to a corporate innovation landscape and basically said, you guys are going to stop doing the thing that you've been comfortably doing for a long time, corporate innovation would stop dead in its tracks at that point.
I think there's a massive difference, right, between corporate and sort of public innovation. Is that if you're a corporate and you create a new service or a new product and a person doesn't like it, they can ignore it and choose something else. Like, if a city does something, you know, creates an intervention in terms of cycling, or, you know, does a car-free road or a school street or something, like, you can't ignore that if you don't like it. And
you can't, like, the places that have done it really well have actually just gone, right, if somebody's screaming into, like, at us, like, saying really loudly, this is, like, I don't like this. As long as there's a cohort of people saying, pretty good. They won't be shouting as loudly, oh, I love this school street, or whatever it might be. I think Paris is the best example of that at the moment. Like, lots of people screamed really loudly at the mayor of Paris because she changed things.
Yeah.
But a lot of other people going, well, that's kind of good. Let's just see where this runs. And like, you then need the leader who has the ability to see it through. In the corporate perspective, you kind of, like, most great strategies tend to have somebody quite loudly going, like, that's really not going to work, I don't like it. And then the leader that's like, well, let's just give it time and see what happens. Like, the classic would be like Amazon Prime with Bezos, where like every single one of his execs was like, Jeff, please don't do this. This is such a bad idea. And he was like, well, I'm the boss. Let's just like play it through. And if it doesn't work, we'll walk it back. And Amazon Prime, everybody has Amazon Prime, basically.
Yeah. I think that comes back to the systems thing as well, right? At some point, you have to have someone who just believes in it enough to push it through. And that's the same in corporate and in public, I think. I sometimes get the sense that it's, I don't know, I feel like I'm contradicting myself because, yes.
Pretty healthy.
Like, yes, councils, like, there's a lot of evidence base built up around decisions and things. But I think there's a good amount of judgment there as well.
So I think there's a different, like, in most corporate organizations, the people who are making the decisions are, like, they've been in that organization or that industry all that time, even if they've come from a different industry, different organization, that kind of company for a long time. A lot of people, I've just told someone before I started recording with you, who was like, oh yeah, when I was 21, I was on Lambeth Council. And it's, and like, the an episode that will have come out by the time this one comes out, there's a guy who's been on Wandsworth Council, and he's like, I didn't know anything about transportation, but I was the transportation cabinet member. Like, there's you can often get like a naivety in councils or in cities that, like, maybe that works really well in your favor as an elected member who knows a lot. Maybe it really doesn't as an elected member who's a bit of a wally and asking really stupid questions and delaying the whole process. But I don't, like, and I'm just literally thinking this through as you said it, but, like, there must be something around that sort of, there's a diversity in a council member or an elected member of a like local and government institution that can be a massive help or a massive hindrance. But in some ways, having people that are not necessarily all at the same stage of tenure probably helps your ability to take some risks. And maybe some of those are smart risks and maybe some of those are dumb risks.
Yeah, I can see that. Does it work in the same way in Canada? So it's in the UK, like a local council, you've got elected councillors. Yeah. You've also got the
city, basically, the administration. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
So if let's pick Toronto, because I started the whole podcast by picking on Toronto, but you'll have like an elected mayor, and then you'll have a set of elected councillors, and then you'll have like the city administration.
Yeah.
But like, I find it really interesting because by and large, the city administration people like actually know what works and what doesn't. Most of them are terribly paid compared to like if they went and took a job in the private sector. And most of them are like quite under-resourced, or the resources are not aligned in the right places. And then you have councillors who will be like, sometimes they'll support the mayor, sometimes they won't support them. They don't necessarily work as a common team. So Toronto has that problem. But councillors can like get very squirrely of, oh, while I know this is the right thing for the city, I don't necessarily want to do this in my district of the city. So you don't necessarily incentivize the right behavior. And then Montreal's really interesting because Montreal's one of the few. So Montreal's pretty more like the UK. Most cities in North America don't have political parties.
Mm-hmm.
Montreal has like local political parties. So you don't get like the Labour Party or the Liberal Democrats or the Conservatives or whatever. But you'll get like the one at the moment, the ruling party is called Projet Montreal.
Okay.
And they were started by a slightly autistic man who was obsessed with the idea of building trams in Montreal. And they went through various cycles of very scrappy, quite left-leaning people coming together to try and like get this guy to be mayor. And he basically never even won a district. So like you run to be mayor in Montreal as a leader of a political party. But then they also have borough mayors. So like subdivisions of the city will have their own mayor. And so like they got their start by this quite radical guy. He became borough mayor in the Plateau, which is like the cool hipstery bit of Montreal. And then so he started making some changes and people were like, so he did things like widening sidewalks, putting in bike lanes, making certain streets one way, so two one-way streets would come together so you couldn't use them as rat runs. He literally got death threats, like people hated. He was like, oh, I'm just gonna do everything I can and then 4 years they'll like kick me out, and, like people like he was hated, vilified, would get death threats, and then 4 years later got an increased majority. And then they got another borough mayor. And then it was only like once this leader, like, there's complications around it, but he compromised and like sided with like the establishment because they were going to build a transit system. And a new outsider came along and the next election cycle, she became mayor for that political party. So like there's something really interesting. The Montreal system to me means that people can fuck around and find out in a way.
Yeah.
Because it's like they're doing it like not, they're a mayor for, I don't know, 50 blocks. So you can go play around in that area, and if it works then other mayors will be like, oh, I'm gonna go steal some of their ideas. To me that works really, really nicely. But you also get like a really healthy dose of amateurism where some things can just be shit.
I think that's really nice. You mean, so I think when I started this project I only had the sort of surface level knowledge of how like a local council works. I think now it's a little bit deeper. But I think that, you know, when you texted me the other day saying, let's talk about what cities can learn from corporate innovation, I think I was still thinking about our last chat, which was around, like, process. And I think that certainly in the UK, like, the average person is so politically disengaged, even at a local level. And I think part of that is because it's really unclear, like, on the process for how changes happen. Like, so in my local area, so I live in Ham, which is between Richmond and Kingston, and it's actually really annoying because my sort of the centre of my community is in a different borough to where I actually live because the border is like 10 metres away from my house, which is a bit annoying. But I get a magazine, the Ham and Petersham magazine, every quarter or something. And it basically just keeps tabs on like the local development projects and things that are going on, and like... you know, I think the editor has very strong views on which ones are good and which ones are not, and uses it as a platform to say, you know, come and object to this one here, or this one is, you know, there's a meeting being held about this one, come along that and voice your support and things like that. And so I'm starting to get more of a sense of like what's going on in the area and like what the proposals are and things. But actually, like, where do those ideas come from? Is it just councillors and administrators like thinking of things? I've never been invited to any like local outreach around here to sort of, you know, share my views around things. And even if it is like a, you know, a share your view type thing, it's usually, you know, it's the worst bits of corporate innovation.
Share your view about why you don't want this.
Yeah. It's like, and you know that nothing's going to happen because I think most people are, actually, I'm tarring everyone with my brush, but I think that by the time someone says, come and share your view on this planning proposal, it's going to happen. Like,
I think that's different. I think often when it becomes share your view on this planning proposal, it's often a, please help us stop this thing from happening.
You think? I don't know.
Maybe this is a like cynic in me, but again, I've done quite a few of these conversations now. I think that, and I think it can run both ways, but I always find it fascinating. Like, housing's the obvious one in the sort of North American context, because it often tends to be like a zoning. We want to protest against this zoning thing, from single family homes to buildings that can have four apartments and whatnot. And people go, oh, it's going to ruin the character of the neighborhood.
Yeah.
But the only people that get a say in that tend to be the people who, and the loudest people ever say in it, tend to be the immediate naysayers, and they just want to keep everything the same because they don't like change.
Mm-hmm.
But the people who might get a potential future of living in that neighborhood, they don't ever get any consultation until the thing is built, and they only get the consultation if I would like to buy that place or rent that place.
Mm.
So I think there's like a, I just think consultation has a huge, I don't know how to solve this, but like, I think there's a huge problem of at what point do you bring the right voices in?
Yeah.
So
yeah.
If we went back to like days when we were doing lottery stuff, there was like an IT security dude who was basically no to everything, because anything new represented a threat to his realm of IT security.
Mm-hmm.
Because anything new, he knows everything he has. He doesn't understand everything he doesn't have, even if it might help it. And there was a legal guy who's like, we would try and involve both of them early, but the legal guy would be like, oh yeah, broadly, you can do these things over here. Here be dragons, tread carefully. And I find it sort of interesting if the... you kind of learn when to bring these people in at like, at what point, like, you know what, never involve the IT security guy early, because he's always just going to like crush it.
Yeah.
Like basically get it to the point where it's basically a yes, and he looks like a bit of a dick for saying no. I'm like, it's not the way it should, like, ultimately that's the way you end up playing the politics. And like...
yeah. Or it's thought through to a level that you can actually like...
yeah.
Think about it properly.
And cities are naturally political.
Mm.
But like it becomes then at what point there's consultations where it's a... I know I'm going to needle you with this, but I'd actually like to understand where it's going to piss you off so I can come back and make sure I alleviate your genuine concerns. But then the person just says no to it. Like, you could probably say, oh, we're going to build like your favorite shop in the world. We're going to put one really close to your house. And they'd be like, no, I don't want it. Like those people, like every community has them. And you kind of then have to be like, right, we're going to put this in front of you. So it, like the conversation is like, how do we say yes to this? Not should we say yes to this? So I don't know how you solve that, but I think that's a really important thing of every good corporate innovating has learned how to handle that, and it becomes more important almost on a municipal or a city lens.
Yeah. And I think the way that you storytell around the things that you're doing, I think is really important as well. Like if you, again, like going back to corporate projects, you know, there's showcases, there's... here are six ideas we've been thinking about, like, and this is, I'm just talking internally with in a corporate setting, like, you know, come and tell us what you think about these ideas, help us improve them. We did a thing, so when we were at Market Gravity, and we helped set up Studio B, which was innovation lab on the high street for Clydesdale Yorkshire Bank, which became Virgin Money, and then the lab became a Virgin Money lounge. But it's one of the things was all the ideas that came out of the lab we showcased in the lab, and using screens on the high street to get ideas from people, and customers could just come in and give ideas. There was a space on the Clydesdale website as well.
Mm-hmm.
And I realized that what I'm talking about there is kind of a bit of crowdsourcing, and it's a bit of open innovation, and it's not very cool anymore. And Starbucks kind of nailed it with the pumpkin spice latte, and no one's done anything good since. But I think it's still just good. I think it's good practice.
Yeah.
Because it helps you to actually work out what's important about that idea. Like, what is the story that you're going to tell? And, you know, back to your point earlier, like, you've got all these different audiences, so how are you going to tell a story on that idea that's going to hit all those different audiences and tell them the benefits of it? And again, like, you just don't, I don't see that in cities or in local councils. Like, stuff is buried in planning documents. Like, you've got to know the code to go and search for to see what the actual proposal is. It's ridiculous.
You just triggered the thought in me. So there's a guy, interviewed him for a couple of things before, but I haven't interviewed him for this, but we probably should. It's called Henry Coutinho Mason. He's the trend watching guy who did that Future Normal book. But his keynotes, the thing he does in his keynote speaking now is he basically says to everybody, scan this QR code, draw a thing on a piece of paper, upload the picture of it, and then AI will turn it into something that like looks visually communicable. And it's broadly like good at saying like, this is what this person was thinking. So there's a lot of times, like, we've had it when we do these recordings, like, we can't necessarily articulate quite what we mean, and we do a terrible job with our words. And I like to think we're generally quite good at explaining conceptual things. But I really like what he's done with that. And he just does it. I think he's still playing around with it and experimenting with it. But I think there's a much bigger use case of, like, actually, there's lots of things that exist in people's heads for what they would like their street or their city to look like. Or here's a problem, whether it's falls or what, here's a problem that they're struggling with, and that this might be a solution to it. But it's hard to visualize and articulate.
Mm.
And likewise, consultation tends to be we're doing this kind of thing. And people are like, I don't know what those words mean. I don't know what that code means. I don't know what this, like, what does this planning application revolve around? Blah, blah, blah. Yeah. So then the natural inclination is, like, I don't fully understand this, so no will be my answer. Or I'm like, generally it's like apathy, but some people will say no. A few people will say yes to a thing they don't properly understand.
Yeah.
There's a really interesting thing in Toronto of, like, they're building, like, a new subway line, and the various bits along the subway line, the transport developer Metrolinx has these offices, and I think in their head it's meant to be this is where people can come in and sort of learn about the construction, share a concern, provide an idea. They don't look very inviting places to go into, often less enclosed, and then when they do a consultation or, like, an open house event, they'll announce it quite late, so then people are like, well, I can't go to it. If I'd known about it a week earlier, I would go. So your point around, like, I think it's a really interesting problem for corporate innovation here too, but, like, when corporate innovation was more office based, normally you would create a physical space in the office or the studio, be example of, like, here's where we're showing our working and people can get involved. The more that work becomes, like, you're in the office sometimes, but, like, your overlap with your colleagues is less. We've actually never made great digital tools for here's what we're working on. And a lot of time people don't want to share what they're working on because they're concerned that people will object to it. So I think there's, like, a really interesting thing of, like, how do you do this sort of, here's the thing, here's the sort of general direction that we're going in, here's the things that we're thinking about. We welcome your input. And then give people ways that they can contribute, because some people are very verbal, some people write letters, most people can't draw. So to bring it back to Henry's thing, I actually think it's really interesting if, like, sketch out an idea and be like, then you can explain it better.
Yeah.
And then hopefully that leads you to better places.
I really like that as a great application of AI. Like, if you think about, like, architects' renderings as the sort of, you know, that's the tool of the architect and the city to, like, say, look, this is what it's going to be.
Some architects' renderings are amazing, though, and some are so bland and banal, like, it's the same sort of generated stick figures plonked into a streetscape that, like, you can sort of end up tuning out with them, and some of them are, like, so fantastic, you're like, oh, I never believe you'll build that.
Yeah.
So they're almost like they're a great tool, but in the same way that, like, you need variety, right?
There's so much development going on in Kingston at the moment, and a lot of, like, the new buildings, like, because it's that sort of early summer light, and, like, if you go in the afternoon, like, cause the light's quite sort of flat, like, they genuinely just do look like architects' renderings, like, it's quite amazing. I should take my photos of them. But yeah, kind of giving those tools to make it a truly sort of participatory and an open process, I think like that could be really cool.
Yeah,
and de-jargonize it as well. Yeah, I think that'd be very cool. I was going to say, so opposite my house, there's basically a big industrial estate.
Yeah, I always forget that about your house.
Yeah, it's really glamorous. It's really glamorous. It's great, though, because we do loads of, like, DIY, and the fact that there's a builder's warehouse and a timber merchant and a paint shop and Screwfix is super, super handy. But there was planning application put in ages and ages ago to turn one of them into flats, and it was denied. I'm butchering this story entirely. It was like, it was a council process or something. They basically were like, what would this look like if we turned it into flats? Like, how many flats would it be? Like, how would we do it? And in the last local council election, so it was Lib Dem council, and Labour, actually, it wasn't the councillor, it was someone, like, supporting the councillor, and they put together this leaflet that was like, look at this planning application that's gone in for these flats, look what's going to be opposite your house. And they did this mock-up of, like, the worst pebble dash, like, 1970s like council flat block that they could possibly find. And just, like, you know, smashed it badly onto a picture of, like, the roadside over here, and like, I immediately looked at that and was like, well, that's just scaremongering, like, bollocks. My next door neighbor was like, have you seen what Lib Dem are planning to do? And, like, yeah, that there is a lot of power in those, that imagery, and being able to produce those sorts of striking images.
So a guy that I've previously interviewed on here, but I won't put his name out, and I told him to not do this, and now I'm like, oh, maybe I shouldn't have told him to not do this. But he wanted to make fake petitions of like all the stuff that doesn't happen in Toronto. He wanted to be like, what if I just make a fake petition? Just be like, let's get a load of fake names and AI bots to sign up to it so we can actually have a proper conversation with councillors. I said, don't do that, mate. Like, because as soon as you've done that, like, and like, he might be doing it with like a good reason, but as soon like you erode all the trust. And he said, well, the bad guy's going to do it, so I may as well do it first. I was like, don't do that. And then literally 2-3 weeks late, like there's like a thing, and I don't think it was in Toronto, I think it was another city, but like basically a lot of people against the development that was going to be broadly positive for the local group had made a fake AI thing of like, mm-hmm. here's all these fake names that have like pushed a study out and then got real people got like a lot of real people signing it. And I was just like, yeah, I know. I don't know. I just want to be the good guy here.
Yeah, like, yeah.
It's amazing how effective those things are. But at what point does it get you to a place where, you know what, like a hand-drawn architect sketch is going to be far more convincing than the most utopian or dystopian vision of the world or whatnot?
Yeah. Oh, super interesting. So many people just want to, go with the majority.
Yeah.
And this, if you say it to someone like, oh, you know, 1,000 people in your area have said no to this, you go, I'll say no as well then.
Yeah, they must know something that I don't, so I don't want to be on the wrong side here. Yeah.
It's fascinating.
It's always interesting. You see it in the sense of whenever, and I'm sorry, I'm back on the sort of transportation and bike thing, but like cities will install a bike lane, or they'll say like, there's going to be no parking here, we're going to put like a bus free or whatever it might be. Mm-hmm. All the local retailers go like, no, we don't want this, you're going to kill our business, yada, yada, yada. And then 18 months later, they'll be like, oh, how's your business doing since this got installed? And they're like, yeah, we're actually making more money. People come in more. People stop more. We were wrong. And like broadly, they actually are quite vocal of like, we were wrong.
Hmm.
But no one ever tells those stories terribly well of like the what we presumed and then what actually played out. Because and it's the same like sort of a lot of cities and a lot of transportation is bad news stories. So you'll get like LNER is a great example of this in like for trains in the UK, like, 2 days a year, there'll be high winds and the electricity wires will go down and people will be like chaos across. But no one talks about like train runs on time for 11th day in a row. Like it's like cities tend to be bad news story. They're sort of bad news story fodder for the media.
Yes.
And when you're doing things in corporate environments, like the bad news stories, like you have to manage them. But broadly, they don't go around like a sort of virus in the organization of like, look how the innovation team are pissing our money up the wall. Like it tends to be a sort of resigned, if the innovation team are doing something that's a bit naff, it tends to be like, oh, they're at it again. But it doesn't become like a, how do we stamp out these guys doing something interesting?
Yeah.
So I think that's like a really interesting thing to battle through.
Did you see a couple of weeks ago, maybe a couple of months ago now, the London Mayor's office put out quite a lot of noise around how effective the ULEZ zone has been?
I didn't see that, no.
Yeah, because obviously that was like massively controversial. And they expanded it, which is controversial as well. And I think the story was that when they did the initial study of like, what's the potential impact of this? I think they said it would take like 150 years to get London's air pollution levels like down to like what they were aiming for, like acceptable new standards. And you know, we've done it in 2 or 3 or whatever it is.
Yeah.
But yeah, it was a big sort of media push around that, and Sadiq has been on the radio loads around air quality and pushing air quality and rivers as well. Maybe jumping on the Paris bandwagon, but he's you know making pledges around making the rivers swimmable and just nice places to be.
I did see a thing about kids like playing in the Thames, like in central London, the other day.
Yeah,
there was like someone was like filming kids paddling on one of those like little beach bits when the tide's down.
Yeah,
on the South Bank. I was like, at first I looked at it and went, ooh, and I'm like, oh, okay, this is a good news story, but I've been so conditioned of like that river is so manky that I'm assuming it's like an article like saying about how bad it is that kids are doing this.
It's the Thames is the According to a book on rivers that my son is reading at the moment, it's the third cleanest river in the world.
Really?
According to this book.
Wow. So like I've only been in the Thames once. Actually, I've only been in the Thames in central London once, and I paddled as like a St. Patrick's Day, like paddle down the river.
Mm.
And I just remember like putting a paddle in from the canoe and pulling it up, and just endless amounts of garbage and quite a lot of condoms being like picked up on the on the paddle. So yeah, these are good news stories that if they are true, like yeah. It's weird that nobody talks about them more.
I mean, the Thames is a long river, right? Like it's from Oxford to Essex.
Yeah, we're just counting the bits in Oxford and the bits in Essex. We're not counting the bit in the middle. Yeah, fair enough. One of the bit, like, oh, I'm going to come to the magic wand question for you in a minute. But before we do that, the bit that I was like, that you sort of triggered in my mind is lots of corporate innovation is like additive. It's we're doing this new thing and we're not, and we, because we've done the new thing, we might turn off the old thing later. But a lot of urban innovation is thou shalt stop doing this thing so we can do this other thing.
Yeah.
And I wonder if that is like a sort of big difference between the two, that in some cases can lead to much more. So ULEZ as an example, for them, like you're literally saying you can't do the thing you used to do. And our innovation is you will pay as a punishment to do it. And then you will go and buy a new car or you'll use some of our new super loop bus services. But it's mostly you're going to stop doing this, and we hopefully put in the conditions where you don't need to do the old behavior. Whereas like that's a lot harder to do as a storytelling exercise and a behavior change exercise, because you're stopping people from doing something they've been established for doing. Corporate innovation tends to be, we're going to offer you the new thing and hopefully you'll switch to the new thing. I think this is I'm curious for your take on that
as to which is better, or as
not
to...
better. I think like maybe there's a case that for urban innovation, there needs to be a little bit more of provide people options that they will choose from, rather than be like, this is the better solution. And like, let people feel that they had agency in the behavior change, rather than be told at them that you shouldn't drive your car in the city, or you should live in a different kind of house, or whatever it might be.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, because I do a lot of, think about a lot, I don't know, but behavioral science is kind of a core part of what I think about when I do these innovation things. And the prevailing wisdom in that, because it's largely been done in the service of like public realm, right, is give people choice. Don't be paternalistic. Think, you know, preserving agency is the most effective route to actually getting people to change behaviors, right? Because no one likes to be told what to do. I think a lot of that sort of public realm innovation, like for it to be done by the city, you kind of have to take away a little bit of choice, because you can't afford to, like, if you're gonna, I think what
you
I
can't
say
afford
is
to be all things to all people.
Yeah. And if you need to do that, then I think you start farming it out to operators and, you know, let the market decide. I think what's interesting is that corporate innovation is ultimately all geared around, like, how do we increase revenue? And
Or cut costs. Mostly increase revenue.
Yeah. But the sort of value equations, the value is measured in exclusively in money. I realized that I started this podcast by saying there's such a commercial lens and a commercial outlook when it comes to doing things in the public realm. But I think that they're better at measuring value in different ways.
Or different time horizons.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think that leads to all sorts of different possibilities that you can't get in a corporate setting. So I'm talking around this a lot. I've kind of forgotten what your original question was.
It was more that, so in corporate innovation, most things are additive. You're not saying you need to stop doing a thing. A lot of urban innovation is like saying we're going to change behavior by doing more of this and doing less of this. But there's as often as much saying we're not going to do this anymore as there is we're doing this. Whereas I think in corporate innovation, things will get turned off, but they tend to get turned off once the market is decided.
Yeah.
And there are things in urban innovation where it's like a, actually, these are things that humans are always going to selfishly do. You actually then need to gently encourage them. And then when at first go through the, oh, how dare you not let me do that thing? And then later on they go, oh, this is actually nicer. But they wouldn't have necessarily got there by themselves. And the media environment doesn't help. And to bring it back to your like social care one is a really nice example. It's like you probably don't have people from the council fighting to be credited with the benefit that they have to the NHS, because they know the massive part of our budget is adult social care. So we're making a massive difference to our cost and ability to deliver good adult social care. If that saves the NHS money, whoop-de-doo, fucking great. Whereas in a corporate, if an organization, if a part of that business does something that has an impact on another bit of the business, typically you end up being like, well, we want credit for the improvement there because it's going to impact our bonus.
Yeah.
Whereas, again, I've said this before, most people who work in civic functions tend to be like undervalued, underpaid. So there isn't the incentive function for them to go after chasing that, and that's a good thing.
I think that the, you know, that culture of experimentation that we touched on before, like, it means that I think local councils are much happier to say, we will trial this for 3 months and see what happens, because we know that there are strong opinions about this, but we know that opinions do not equal behavior. So let's just do it and try it and see what happens, and then make a decision about whether to continue it or not. And I think, again, it's that sort of culture that I think allows you to do things that are a bit more, maybe not subtractive, but replacative? Substitutory.
Yeah. I got what you meant, don't worry.
I can go on inventing new words. Whereas, yeah, in corporates, like, you know, someone owns the thing, right? And no one wants their baby to die. Especially because there is always a risk of if that baby dies, sent out with it.
I love the sort of the two-way door thing that you can kind of get often more permission to try something. I think like street closures are a nice example of like, oh, can we close this street for a block party? And then people go, oh, we're supposed to do that for a block party. What if we did it for a week or for the summer?
Yeah.
Hang on. What if we did it all year? And then if we did that, what other things would we add on to it? So it becomes like there's momentum, there's an addictive behavior of what can we keep doing if this works? And if it doesn't work, it's like, okay, I can go back to what we did before.
Yeah. And but again, there has to be a good communication around it. And so if I think there's an example, sorry, I'm pointing up the road. So Richmond Park is not far from where I live. One of the main entrances at Kingston Gate, like main car entrance, they're very narrow roads, essentially. And it gets really busy and the roads all get backed up. There's hundreds of cyclists, if not thousands. And it all gets, very, very congested, which is not very nice for anyone. So they trialed a scheme of turning those roads into one-way streets just to like ease the flow around. But there was absolutely no communication that I could see around, like, was this trial successful? They're still there. They're still blocking it. So I'm assuming yes, but I don't know. I'll have to ask my mate Ed that lives on one of the streets and see if he's had any comms about it. But it would be great. And to your point around like celebrating successes, like we trialed a thing.
Yeah.
We were expected to see these outcomes. We did. So we're carrying on.
And these other things happened as well.
Yeah.
I think that's the interesting bit.
Yeah.
So magic wand. You can apply a magic wand to your industrial estate across the road. You can apply it to your adult social care trial. You can apply it to Bradford. I don't care. What would you do if you got a magic wand where like you don't have to be so grounded in reality when it comes to making better cities? What would you do with it?
Ooh. So I think about Bradford a lot, right? So I didn't put this in my intro. I grew up in Bradford. It's an ex. It was an incredibly wealthy city in the 1800s of Britain during the Industrial Revolution, and then was not when we
it has
no
fallen
longer,
on hard times.
Yes, when we stopped making wool and making excellent cloth, and the whole textile industry sort of died out. Bradford sort of died out with it. And a while ago, there was a local councillor in the Guardian saying that she wanted Bradford to become the Shoreditch of Yorkshire.
That's one of those things that you say and sounds really clever, and then when you actually said it, you're like, oh, hang on a minute, I wish those words hadn't come out of my mouth.
100%. And I sent that article around to all my like friends and family that still live in Bradford or around Bradford, as most of my friends sort of moved back to the areas around it, and was like, I don't understand what she's trying to say, because basically what she means is I want Bradford to become a thriving cultural hotspot that becomes really famous and prosperous and wealthy. I think that's what she's saying, because that's what's happened to Shoreditch. I don't think she wants rents to go sky high. I don't think she wants massive apartment complexes to be built and people to be priced out and have to move to, I don't know, Hull. I'm saying Hull because when my parents moved to Bradford, their choice was Hull, which was the least expensive place in the UK, or Bradford, which was the second least expensive place to buy a house in the UK. So all this to say that I think my magic wand I would use to somehow help people who are in positions of influence and authority within cities to accept the trade-offs that you have to have in place in order to kickstart a flywheel that turns you into a Shoreditch or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
So what I mean is, like, Shoreditch got cool because it had dirt cheap rents, and so lots of artists and creative types moved there. Lots of creative agencies started moving there when all the artists moved there, and then the transport links came, and then the bankers started moving there, and all that. That was the flywheel, right? If you're sitting in Bradford, where the rates, like the business rates for operating a shop, are prohibitively expensive, it is not going to happen. So yeah, that's what my magic wand would be, just like giving some sense and perspective, like drop the rates, encourage the artists that are struggling in Leeds over to Bradford. That's how you kickstart it, in a very simplistic way.
There's a lovely counterintuitive thing of, actually, like, if you make something cheaper, you will sell more of it and you will make more money.
Yeah.
And I think, like, there's a lot of cities that are quite broken that then go, right, we're broke, we're going to up the taxes or the rates, and then more people leave, or it becomes a disincentive for people to go and start a thing.
Yeah.
And if you look at all the cool places, because someone didn't really need permission, they had more agency to go try a thing and see what happens. And ultimately they get shoved out, and then they go to Hackney, and then they end up in Margate, and I don't know where they go after that.
France.
Bradford.
On that trajectory. Yeah. But I mean, but you know what? Bradford is the capital of culture this year. So it's got a load of money to spend.
They made Hull the capital of culture not that long ago. I'm always a bit dubious of those accolades.
I mean, Bradford has apparently a rich film industry heritage.
I've seen East is East.
Yeah, I think it's based on East is East.
I think that's actually Manchester. But, yeah.
Railway. Did you watch The Railway Children when you were a kid?
No, I know it, but I don't remember.
Okay. And then I think Rita Sue and Bob 2 was filmed there.
Okay.
And I think that's its film heritage. I don't know, there's some great stuff. Have you ever seen Don McCullin's photographs of Bradford? Oh, they're great. They're absolutely fantastic. They're everything you think that they should be.
Okay, I'm going to go Google this.
War photographer taking photos of a post-industrial town in the city.
I mean, growing up in Burnley, like, Burnley and Bradford are not all that different.
No, they're not.
Both got their rough edges, but both have their charms. But most of their charm is the countryside near it.
Actually, maybe, do you know what? Maybe, can I retract my magic wand?
You can have another one if you want.
Have I told you about this thing of, so in Nigeria, you have to go to university in a different part of the country to where you went to school.
Big believer in this.
Yeah.
I did not know that was a thing, but that's
sense. That is a thing. And I think...
Does that mean you just go to the university in a different, like, another bit of Lagos that's 2 hours away because Lagos is so big and so congested?
I don't know how it works in practice. But, yeah, moving parts of government, moving or insisting that parts of central government do tours of duty in Northern England.
Yeah.
Like, you know, there is so much that we could do in the UK to kind of address the balance between North and South.
Yeah. I have this issue in Canada of, like, a lot of people go to university in, like, the city where they grew up. Or, like, so people from Toronto go to University of Toronto.
Yeah.
Or they might go to Waterloo, and it's like, you should actually, and then it doesn't help that Quebec is putting, like, a tax on, like, people from outside Quebec going to university in Quebec.
Mm-hmm.
But, like, they should be encouraging, like, if, like, I said this to my cousin, he's like, I think he was a bit disappointed his kids went to university and stayed living in the family home.
Mm-hmm.
I think a little bit of him was like, bugger off, go get out of our house, go live somewhere else.
Yeah.
But it's really
more
important.
More and more people are doing it in the UK. They're staying, commuting to university. Like, they might not go to, you know, if you're in Bradford, you might not go to Bradford, you might go to Manchester or Sheffield or something, because, you know, you can drive there in an hour or so. But, like, it's just the cost. People are doing it to just save on cost.
Yeah. It's important to go live somewhere else.
Yeah. And also, if you're going to do lectures on video call, like, why go somewhere else is the argument.
Yeah. I think about this for graduate recruitment programs, because like they're a big thing in the UK, but they're not a thing in North America.
They're not.
Like cycling people around different roles or different bits of an organization. And I think that has a massive impact on their ability to do innovative things.
Yeah. Yeah.
Maybe we do one on a future sidebar on that.
Yeah, on like ways to stimulate foster more innovation.
Yeah, I like that.
Yeah, that'd be cool.
Good stuff. I enjoyed this. It's nice to get you. I know I've talked a lot, but more than I do on a Challenger City thing, but I feel like you've talked more than you do on a sidebar thing, so it's good.
Good. No, this has been fun. This has been fun. It's helped me straighten out some thoughts, I think, around this sort of stuff.
So, sweet. Yeah. Let's go do more open innovation stuff.
I think we should. It's fun.
Terrific. See ya.
Thank you once again for listening all the way to the end of a Challenger Cities podcast. Really do appreciate it, as always. And if you can give it a like, share, leave us a comment, that's always really, really helpful for growing this thing. If there's likewise people that you think would be fantastic for us to interview, please do send them along. Always interested in new ideas and new voices that we should be getting out there. I produce these podcasts mostly as a bit of a labor of love, but also because I really want to make an impact on making cities better places to live, play, and work. I do a lot of that through my consulting business called Now and Ever. Basically, we're really, really good at going out and looking at what I call next practices rather than best practices. So the things that are relevant for companies to be doing next rather than homogenizing themselves with what people are already doing now. Do a lot of customer ethnography, so spending time with real people to understand actually what they think and how they behave and all their weird and wonderful quirks. And then a lot of prototyping. So what does it all mean? What's the implication of these things that we learn? What might we do about it? And how can we go and experiment with it? So very keen to do more of that with cities, more of that with policy, more of that with companies that should really genuinely just give more of a care about the urban physical realm. So that's my plug. Thanks again, and we'll see you on a new episode very, very soon.